Willkommen zum Podcast der Initiative Regenerative Marktwirtschaft. Hier wollen wir herausfinden, wie eine umweltfähige Zukunft macht.
Welcome to today's episode of the podcast of the Initiative for the Regenerative Market Economy, where we explore what a good life might look like and how to get to that for all of us. And I'm super happy to have Neil here today with me. We just recently met, so this is a great opportunity for me to get to know you even better. And I invited you on the spot in our last conversation because I felt we were so mission aligned that I just wanted to have this deeper dive here. So with all of that, first, and probably one of the more difficult questions is, who's Neil?
Well, really thankful to be here and to share a little bit about who I am and what I'm doing in this little planet we call Earth. So I grew up in Canada. I was actually born in Brazil, but grew up most of my life in Canada. I grew up in the mountains of Canada, actually, in a little place over on the West Coast. We grew up on a farm, and I've been around agriculture my whole life. And so I've really seen what we need to be doing in our food supply chains, right from the soil to consumption of that food. And though I tried to peel away from agriculture, Thomas, when I entered my teenage years, and move into some different market spaces, what allowed me to continue to scratch a living and continue to find fulfillment was agriculture. And so I've stayed with agriculture my whole career. Who am I, though? I'm someone that really enjoys changing paradigms, someone that likes to challenge conversations, to think about things differently. And it isn't purely for the sake of change. It's because I believe that most of us are stuck in this perplexity of mediocrity, that we need to get beyond what has been simply handed to us or what has been laid out in front of us. So incrementalism is something that I want to get away from. So small little steps. I really want those big leaps. And I think that's what drives me in a lot of the conversations and a lot of things I do and where I've ended up in life is wanting to take bigger steps, wanting to create bigger shifts and bigger paradigm momentums so that we can live a more fulfilled life and so that we can do things differently. I was recently exposed to a talk and somebody had mentioned the problems in our world are giga problems. But everything that everyone was talking about came down to a couple of things that we have the abilities to change. We have the people, we have the technology, we have the abilities. We're just not linking those three together. And so we need to work more collectively. We need to take a look at the technologies that are at hand and not create massive. We have to take technology and make it smaller and make it bite-sized and usable. And then we certainly have the brain power and the ingenuity to take on some of these giga problems. So that's a little bit who I am. I love to windsurf. I love to be on the water. That's my escapism. I find a lot of my time on land. It is really fulfilling when I'm in nature, around trees. I mean, I grew up in the mountains, so that is something that really centers me. And I'm someone that's found more peace as of late in really understanding the energies that come from nature. And so finding myself meditating and grounding myself with those very Mother Nature characteristics allows me to have a very clear head and an understanding of where we're going.
Okay, cool. So you talked about big leaps. I want to take a big leap back to your first big leap, which was from Brazil to Canada. And so how did that happen? How did you end up being born in Brazil? And why did you then jump to Canada? And then why did you end up on a farm there? until you started rebelling against that in puberty?
Yeah, great question. So I had no, I wasn't part of the decisions to be in Brazil, obviously. My father was down there working for a pulp and paper mill. And so he, I always say affectionately, he was cutting down the rainforest. He wasn't. He was working on the financial end for this pulp and paper company. And it was a great opportunity for him to be, you know, moved to a country they had, didn't know much about and really get situated and antiquated. My mother was a nurse and she was also on her own journeys, and Brazil was a spot that allowed them to meet, and really they found just a lot of joy down there, a lot of great times. So myself and my sisters were born in Brazil and we stayed there for a number of years. And then right before we started to think about getting into education, my folks thought that, you know, Canada was maybe the spot to return to go through the educational part of our life. My father was British, born and raised. So we actually went back to England prior to landing back in Canada. And so we spent some time there. And my parents, I think, were always, and probably how they raised me, always a little bit of the black sheep of the family. So when we came back to Canada, they ended up finding this little remote town up in the mountains in British Columbia, Canada. Some of you may know it today as Whistler. It's a ski resort. But when we ended up there, it was very rural, gravel road. And the house that we ended up living on was part of a farm. And we had, it was built from the trees on the farm. And it was an idyllic life, but it was very rural. So we didn't have much infrastructure and really just enjoyed being part of nature. And so that's how I grew up. And that's where we ended up. And we ended up there for a few reasons. One, my father really wanted to get out of finance, which he was doing most of his career up to that point. My mother really wanted to be part of a smaller community and help them grow. So she was the first nurse in town. She set up the first farmer's market. And that's how we ended up in Whistler.
Were you aware of the fact that, at least how you presented it, that your parents were the black sheep of their families?
Mm. And not until later on in life. Great question. Yeah. No, I'd always known that my parents had different views, my grandparents and their siblings, as we had family gatherings and chatted. But it wasn't until I was probably early 20s that I recognized that what my parents had done by even being in Brazil and traveling the world, ending up in a rural town like Whistler, was going against the grain for what society and what their families thought was a meaningful life. And I'm really happy for that. It's allowed me to be exposed to challenging the way, society thinks we should live and how we should go about that and what qualifies as meaningful life. So I was very blessed for that.
And your sisters, would they see you as a black sheep too?
They would. Yeah. They both went into the healthcare sector. So they're nurses. And they followed a path, they stayed close to my family. But I followed in the footsteps of my father, I guess, by and large. I moved away. I moved to a different province in Canada. I ended up in the farming sector and sort of just following different opportunities that came along that were going against the grain for what society, I think, wanted me to do, which was follow my education path and, find a job and then settle down with a house. And I was somebody that was chasing an opportunity to make impacts. And I didn't recognize it at the time, but making an impact not only for myself, but for something greater than myself. And I have found that through the ecological work I do in nature and with the trees, but the people that are surrounding that ecological area. So by and large, a lot of that would be farmers or farm communities and those that eat the food that comes off the farm. But yes, to answer your question, would they see me as a black sheep? Absolutely. I think they've said as much.
Okay. And your parents? Same?
No, I think my parents have just embraced the journey. They've never pushed back on any of the decisions I've made. They've just embraced the fact that I have needed to find multiple different paths to ultimately end up on something that is truly fulfilling. And I've appreciated that. So,
how long did that take you to find the path that was ultimately fulfilling, roughly?
I would say up until 5 years ago. I won't date myself, but I'm in my early 40s. It was only probably about 5 years ago that I really had that clarity of here's what I'm meant to do. And I think you go through that journey, right? As I've reflected and talked to my wife, even in the 20s, you know, really just sort of getting started and trying to understand. Mm-hmm. And in the 30s, I think I was very much someone that was pushing against hanging rope, trying to find that path. Mm-hmm. And so I would, mm-hmm. that's the analogy I give anyway. I was pushing against something that was hanging and really never found centered. And it wasn't until I realized that I needed to stop pushing and let the rope guide me versus pushing it, that I found that path and where I'm meant to be.
Mm. Can you remember a pivotal moment where that's like collapsed into awareness for you a couple of years ago?
Yeah, I think it was right around the time that my wife and I got engaged. Right at the time I transitioned from one company. I had sold a business that I was part of, and I was kind of feeling very lost. And what ended up falling into my lap was an opportunity that I never saw coming. And I remember thinking, wow, I wasn't looking for this, and this just feels right. And I talked to my wife and she said, follow that. And in reflection, that was that moment where I was scared because I didn't have a quote unquote job. I had, you know, sold out of my businesses. I didn't have a plan, the next step, which I typically had. I was really just letting the universe guide me. And what ended up happening, and since then, I felt very similar in everything that's happened. Things just tend to fall into place when I'm not pushing for it, when I'm not planning for it. And I think I'm consciously aware that I need these things in my life, but I'm not trying to grasp for it. And when they do click, it's that sense of calmness. It's that sense of feeling centered and anchored that this is what I need to do, or this is what I was waiting for.
And now that you know what that feels like, is it easier for you to search actively for that path? So building on your analogy with the rope, do you know how to follow the rope?
I think it's always a learning curve. I think the piece that comes into play there is the more aware I am of what the environment has and what I'm learning from the environment, my ecosystems that I live within, the more I'm consciously aware that I need different things in my life. And I think to answer your question, am I able to follow the rope? Yes. Am I consciously aware of what I need? I think I need to continuously ask myself, what are those things that I need in my life in the next 3, 6, 12 months? And remind myself that what is presented to me often isn't the direction the rope's taking me. And it's this check within yourself that, you know, does it feel right? Or does it feel like I'm needing to plan or getting stressed? And I'm very in tune with that stress level. And I think that's probably my guiding light. It's that internal, that stress element. I'm stressing about it too much. Something isn't working. Something isn't clicking.
Good
following time. The rope is not. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which also means that you have to have a sense, at least a felt sense of what's life you're after, what's a meaningful life means, right? And you earlier said that that was in there was some friction between the way your family seemed to think about what a meaningful life is and how the wider family thought about the same thing. But I'm guessing also your different situations of life in Brazil and England or Britain and Canada, etc.
Yeah.
Also showed you different aspects and perspectives. So putting all of that together, how would you describe a good life? What does that even mean?
Yeah, and I think this is a question that all of us are stretching to try to understand. For me, a good life is community. And I say that in a small bioregional sense. You need a strong, you know, foundational community, but you need a community at large. And I think I found that within agriculture is that community that I really love to engage with. And I've certainly been engaged with different market spaces and different, you know, tracks of life in different community settings around the world, but I've been very blessed to be able to work in many different and travel to many different countries. But I think that that core community is what a good life means to me. And what I mean by that is being able to break bread and share stories about what's is so wonderful. So the ability to break bread, I think is very important for me. And that's usually an indication of a quality of life that I think is very important when we're eating with others and being social, and eating food that you've had an ability to put your hand in creating, I think is even more impactful, or have it created for you from someone that has got food that, you know, you've had a hand in creating, is very rewarding. But community is a sense of always being able to know that there are people there that will listen. They don't necessarily need to agree to you, but they will listen. And I found that both in my core community, so my family, my wife and our immediate families, but also with this larger agriculture community. And one of the things I say often is, in North America at least, I can pretty much go anywhere in rural America and there is a farm or a ranch that I could drive up to, and they'll invite me in for dinner. They'll ask me to stay over. You know, we get to understand each other. And there's people that I haven't met in or haven't seen in years. And I know that I could just immediately drive up and be welcomed into their home and into their families. And I think that is very special. And that is a sense of fulfillment and community that we should be, you know, learning and have an ability to travel and get to know people in their own settings, and respect those settings that they come from. The other piece of fulfillment is health. And I think this is something that certainly most people, they do as they get older, they better understand what health means to their life. And we didn't understand when we were younger. But I think health for me is really that centering of awareness that we're needing to take care of ourselves, not in the way that society wants us to take care of ourselves, but needing to do so from a spiritual, from a physical, and from a nutritious standpoint. And when we start to understand how those all interline, that quality of life in terms of how we're living it starts to change. And that's certainly been something that I'm very in tune with now that I never was before.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to try and mirror this back to you to see if I understood correctly through a framework a friend of mine likes to use, which builds on the development of our brain, really. So there's a first switch in our, what people usually call the reptilian brain, safety, not safety, right? If you have to feel safe, right? In order to next level be at ease or not at ease, right? If you feel safe, you can still be not at ease, because you might not be able to say something around the dinner table or something like that.
Right.
Generally, you feel safe, but okay. And then only if you feel safe and at ease, you can really unfold your agency in the world, right? And you're just, to me, you describe something along those lines, saying, I can feel safe because I'm embedded in a community, and that community nurtures me in all the ways I need nurturing. But I can also feel at ease because I know, even if there might be disagreements or we might see things differently, I am at ease describing my world, and yes, we can see where we overlap or not, which then creates the possibility for positive agency in the world. That's how I viewed or heard what you said. Is that roughly right?
Yeah, I would say that's a really great way to describe what I was saying. And it's very much on track to what I was trying to explain. So, yeah.
Cool. That gives us a good foundation for my next question, which is really, really big. Because if you, what you described in other words, I've heard many, many times. Ultimately, it seems like the 300,000 or so years of being human are a bit stronger than the 300 years of destruction by the industrial age, right?
Yes.
So we seem to know something like that inherently. And the question then becomes, although the actual implementation, meaning the kind of shelter or home, the kind of food, the kind of conversation, all of that might differ from bioregion to bioregion, the general conditions are the same. So it's like coherent pluralism, if you will.
Yes. Yeah.
And which is a term I borrow from Jim Rutt, by the way, just to note where the sources are here. And so if we take that and say, okay, let's take that as the core foundation and try to build the infrastructure that is needed for everybody on the planet, 8 billion of us, to live according to those coherent base principles. Based on your experience, on what you do in the world, on what you've seen, what you feel, what would you say are some of the core infrastructural elements that we should have in place so that we can start living into this kind of civilization?
Yeah, wonderful. I love that term, by the way, continual pluralism. That infrastructure that is so necessary for us, and it's there are three major elements for me. One of them being the soils. I think it starts and stops with soils for me. So understanding the soils that are within the ecosystem. And I'm not indicating that somebody needs to tend or steward those soils, but somebody within your community should. But those soils are vastly important to us in an ability to do two other things. One, water source, which we know is very, very important. And two, energy source. And I think both of those stem from what soil conditions we have around us. And so I was speaking just this past week in Florida, and I was talking to quite a few people around, if you don't understand the soils, it's like you don't understand your body. And often one mirrors, you know, we're, if we look at a soil degradation and what we're trying to extract out of it, and then that's what we're consuming, our bodies are often full of chronic disease and have issues. And so we need to mirror what's happening in the soils with what's happening to our health and to our larger spiritual system. Energy and water are those two other elements. And so those, for me, make up the three-legged stool, soil, energy, and water. And the water systems, again, isn't just a drinking source. You know, it's very important to have water that is also cleaning our waste products. It's something that is helping us in terms of some of the environmental impacts that we're talking about today, carbon dioxide, you know, carbon removal. The water system, the small water system in particular, within your own little bioregion, and even more within your own, you know, acreage or small little plot of land, that small water system is, in my opinion, more important to try to work with and tend to and steward than the larger water system. And the larger water system is what we hear on the news, the climatic conditions happening. But it's all driven by the small water systems. And those water systems, much like I talk about, much like going through a cleanse, you know, when we need to detox, that small water system is really allowing the earth to detox and your little environment to detox. And it does something wonderful on the back end of it. It provides drinking water, which nourishes us long term. And it also helps us provide nutritious food, et cetera, and so forth. On the energy side, we often dismiss some of the things that we can create very simply to have energy. And there's this electrical field that's available both below the soil and above the soil in this ether realm. And so whether you're creating photosynthesis or photovoltaic from the sun's rays, and anchoring that into the soils to create a larger electronic field of capability, or whether we're using a geothermal source, heat that is resonating up, depending on what bioregion where you live and what those needs are. But the source of energy that comes from your soil types and, you know, that infrastructure that you're building around it allows us to think about how we can live differently. We are very dependent on resources that are depleting quickly, and yet we have the ability and the capabilities to live very differently. So I've got a small property in Saskatchewan, Canada. It is by and large off-grid. We do have a grid-tied connection, but I use geothermal, photovoltaic, have my own water systems, grow my own food, and I could live very peacefully in a very meaningful way without anyone else, you know, needing to bring any other infrastructure in. So much so that at minus 40 Celsius or minus 40 Fahrenheit, which in Canada where my farm is, we get to that temperature often every year for multiple weeks, if not colder. I don't have a furnace. I don't have an air conditioner in the summertime, which we have the opposite. I just have a self-facing passive house that is dependent on the energy from nature and the soils around me that are holding the water systems that I have stored tanks of, which I can pull off of during the winter, and stored food that I've grown on my property. And so those three give us the infrastructure that we really need, and an ability to to live very differently. And I use the cold climates as a case point that if we can do it in cold, you know, the reverse is true in the heat. But the cold is very hard to think about living at those temperatures, and yet we have the abilities to do so in a very easy way.
And so just to repeat, so is you've the absolute foundation for all of this is, as I understood, soil. Because everything comes from there and everything goes there.
You ultimately. Got it. Yes.
Then there's a watershed that helps with that, right? That's facilitates, that gives life or energy, a certain kind of energy to that soil.
Absolutely.
Recycling.
Yeah.
And then there's even a larger cycle around this where you, where all of that comes together. And the big fusion reactor in the sky provides the energy to turn CO2 and other molecules with the help of water and soil into sugars and into other molecules that we can then use to feed ourselves and to build and all of these things. Right. So am I hearing that in your description?
Absolutely.
Or am I fantasizing? Okay.
No, good. No. And it's those concentric circles. I love that concentric circle, you know, paradigm, the interconnectedness of those, but soil, water, energy. Yeah.
And building on the concrete example you offered here, the house, right? Mm-hmm. You said it's south-facing, meaning that you're using the passive energy basically from the big fusion reactor.
You got it.
And which reminds me of a really, really amazing house design, which is generally known as Earthship.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering about the way you've designed that house, or you found it designed when you moved there, that helps you live in those conditions. Because I know with Earthships, it's completely possible.
Yes.
In the way you described it.
Yes. So it's a very, I would say, Scandinavian design from the outside, very minimalistic, but we use both biophilic products, so products that, you know, we've been able to cultivate off without a lot of synthetic production, so using more nature-based solutions. Larger wall facility, you know, we've got 22-inch walls, but packed with cellulose. So we actually have recycled a byproduct that we have in between the walls. We have self-facing windows, so orientation of the house for where, so we really pay attention to the sun and how it rises and sets, and position the house accordingly. So we've got concrete floors on the inside, and those absorb heat throughout the day, and then during the evening release that heat. And in the summertime, the opposite is true, that the sun still comes in and heats up, but we simply crack windows and you get a little bit of a breeze and you can keep the house. Our house stays roughly 71 Fahrenheit to 74 Fahrenheit year round. You know, it's a temperature.
In Celsius? So
we're talking 24 Celsius. And that was really the design element. So even our roofing structure, the exterior of the roof, and the cellulose in between, really gone to the extent of trying to use products that are, you know, from production to utilization, have a longevity, but come from a biophilic or recycled scenario, closed loop, that provide the mechanism for this house. And so Earthship meets some of that Scandinavian biophilic design structure and really that regenerative, you know, sort of positioning of what that house structure looks like. We did a bit of earthworks. So we dug down. I've got a basement in there. And even in the basement, we have, you know, very, very good temperatures that, you know, we don't need a heating source or a cooling source down there. The other piece there is below our house, we put water cisterns. So something we've gotten away from, I think, in a lot of our design was capturing water. And having cisterns of which we can draw up from, but because it's in the ground at such a depth, we create, you know, there's a heating effect down there, even cold temperatures, but certainly in the heat as well, that allows the water to be very temperate. And what we've done on the roof is we've created some steps. I see this a lot. I actually took this design from Bermuda. If you look at the roofs, they look like steps on all the roofs, and they're painted white. And that white is actually an antibacterial component. So as the water goes through, it helps cleanse some of the bad components, and they catch it in cisterns underneath the house. And so we did similar design. We had to take it into a structure that in the wintertime, if there was any moisture that does melt, if it starts to warm up, you know, it doesn't freeze and melt and expand. The same idea, antibacterial products that allow water to be captured and put into a cistern, and then we bring it up and there's a little bit of filtration, but it allows us to create an opportunity to have water year round from what I believe is some of the best water in the world, rainwater. So rainwater harvest.
So for those who might be worried listening to this, there's a beautiful filtration system out of Guatemala, which basically contains of a clay inlet in a bigger pot that contains carbon and silver nitrate and filters out all microorganisms that might be harmful, but also heavy metals. And so you just replace that filter every year or two, and it gives you water. We use that a lot here on the ship here. And also, just to enforce the idea, with the cellulose layer that you put into the wall, I know that in Germany, 250 years ago, when they built houses out of basically clay and some bricks and wood, they built 60-centimeter walls with an 8-centimeter air gap in the middle, or something like that. I'm being specific here, but with an air gap in the middle, right? So I know of a house that even if you don't heat it, never drops below 8 degrees in winter, regardless of the outside temperature, because of the thermal effect of the mass. Right? It's crazy.
Yeah. There's a lot of wonderful designs that are really challenging the way we've thought about construction and the dwellings that we live in. They create a lot more comfort, I believe. And again, it's this paradigm shift. It's these big leaps. You know, we have the technology and we have the capabilities. Far too often, we're trying to do it on mass production because we're driven by this gluttony of profitability and, you know, but we're not thinking about how we can actually affect someone's life simply by slowing down and utilizing those biophilic products that are, you know, available in your local community without having to ship long distances for the climate that you live in. And we can get there. We can certainly get there. We can retrofit what's already there in terms of infrastructure. So it's not like we have to knock down and restart again. But we need to think about moving into these areas. I'm talking about dwellings, and that's just one aspect of our overall health and benefit and for our environments.
And I know you're not sitting there in your dwelling in just enjoying life, but you're doing more than that. And that's an interesting question. I think that's within that scope of what you said, running after profitability and maximization of profits and whatever. I have come to call it the dichotomy between two ways of bringing ideas into the world: masculine and feminine scaling. Masculine scaling is more or less the way Silicon Valley bro culture does it. You find a solution that's totally valid, you blow it up to planetary size, you stuff the planet inside, think Facebook and Google, etc. And you force everything into one way of doing things, which is not really life affirming, right? Because as you know, every bioregion is different, every bit of soil is different, right?
Correct.
And fragile, right? Watersheds are fragile. So feminine scaling says, oh, I have a solution here. It works for me in my context. Why don't you take it and see if it works for you and adapt it and pass it on?
That's right.
And I have the sense that both are valid and viable, and that there is a dance between them that can make life-serving, life-affirming solutions that we need right now on the planet spread much more quickly.
Yes.
And just wondering about your thoughts and experiences in that field, because I think there is something to be found.
And I think I fall right in that slipstream in between the masculine and feminine scalabilities of our economies. The thing that's allowed me to find an ability to sort of mirror these two together is a decentralized mindset. And right now, for me, that is introducing what I call the emerging technology blockchain. That is the piece that's, let me back up. Within the male and female economy scales, there's a connectivity there that relies on data. And data from both of those allows us to have different conversations. I think we've moved into an era within our world where data supersedes almost everything, from our research to our scientific to the production to our economies of scale. But what's happened is, like a lot of things in our history and in our life, is that humans want to safeguard that data. So we have these central entities that are taking data and they're centralizing it. So you mentioned some of the social media platforms, not to point fingers at them, but they garner this data and they centralize it and for their own purposes of fulfillment. And so that more male, masculine ability to scale. But we need an ability for everyone to own that data. And so that's that decentralized thinking. And that ability for everyone to do that is what I believe the blockchain offers. Not all the other components that go along with blockchain, those are wonderful. Those can be cherries on top, that decentralized finance. Crypto would be one term for what decentralized finance looks like right now. But the blockchain in itself, an ability to have data that is still owned by the originator, doesn't matter who that is. In my case, a lot of that is, you know, farmers, an ability to share that. So that open sourced, you know, what's happening in Canada is, you know, happening in Costa Rica, is it happening in Australia? What are the similarities and differences? What can we learn? An ability to monetize that. Profit isn't a bad word, but when we chase gluttony from the profitability and a safeguarding of that, that's where we run into trouble. And so the blockchain changes that because we can then have different conversations. I'm seeing it play out real time today where we're having large centralized entities, call them CPGs, consumer packaged goods companies, having direct conversations with data originators, and in my case, farmers. And the blockchain is changing the way they're interacting. No longer are we having a dominance factor happen from one side of the table because they already have a mass amount of data, dictating that we're going to take your data or use your data through different mechanisms. We're flipping the narrative and we're allowing interconnectivity. But that same large entity, small entity, is happening between small and small, medium and medium, large and large, and then all the different variations of that. And I think that's such a wonderful opportunity for us as a human collective to move away from that scarcity mindset, to move into this ability to take on those giga problems that I mentioned at the beginning of our chat here, Thomas. And that's what I get excited about, that, you know, we've moved into this opportunity where technology can actually start creating playing fields, or, you know, as an analogy, where everyone is equal. Everyone has that ability to, you know, have a voice, have a voting mechanism, have a ownership of what's happening, and an ability to share. We start to open source particular information that should be shared for everyone and learn from that. Along the way, we're going to find new mechanisms to create economic scales of growth, where there's what we consider financial mechanisms right now. Those aren't going to change quickly. But we can do so with a completely different conversation and ability to recognize what is needed for me and for my, you know, immediate community and my sort of larger community from that. And I've seen it starting to happen. I actually think there's a lot of green lights happening both from our political standpoint right now. So our nations are starting to recognize this power of what blockchain can do. And we need to just continue to push into that. And it's a big, scary leap, but it's one I believe is very important. And so I'm coming from my little mechanism of soil and agriculture and food security and how we can leverage and harness that blockchain to change the conversations and hopefully bring more opportunities for the global population, but certainly within the areas that we're working within, that where people are going to feel motivated and encouraged that they can do something differently. Where right now, I think there's a lot of people, by and large, in the agriculture community that feel a little bit lost, like we're just being dictated to. We don't know what to do. It's a very scary time. And on the other side of the coin, I think blockchain is really helping bring more peace and comfort that, you know, we can all be part of a solution here.
Okay. So big leap, right? From
huge
talking about soil and watersheds and
yes.
Energy from the sun. You, with a few sentences, dropped us into DeFi and crypto and all of that. And there is an intuition that I sense that is a similar intuition that can be honed, like similar to the intuition around exponentials, for example.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something we usually think about or think in terms of as humans, but we can hone our intuition about around exponentials. And I get the sense that there's an intuition around distribution in the sense of the way blockchains and similar technologies work, distributed ledgers, that helps understand what you just said. And I have a sense, because I see so many people coming out of Canada, that there is something specific about the cultural fabric of Canada that is conducive to this kind of intuition. Trent McConaughey, a friend of mine who started Ocean Protocol, which you might know, which is at the center of the distributed data fabric of the world, really.
Yes.
But he's not the only one. So when you with that participatory knowing of the cultural fabric of the cooperative movement that's is so strong in Canada, that probably is another symptom of something that's happening there. If you go into the world and speak with others, how do you find the allies? How do you find the people that are that understand this, that you don't have to convince and don't lose energy on convincing, but immediately get into coherence and start working on something? How do you do that?
Yeah, great question. I try not to get too lost in this new Web3 world, which is where the distributed letters, blockchain go. I think there's a whole vernacular. Whenever we introduce something, there's typically this whole new language that comes along with it and different terminologies. I focus on the things that I can see as pain points. And so we, you know, I speak to a lot of farmers. What are some of the biggest problems for those farmers? Well, it's an ability just to be able to cover the costs to run that operation. And by and large in North America, I think, we have the same problem, Canada, US, is that there's a lot of dependence on a centralized, rebate or grant system or some sort of political program that is covering the delta or the difference on not being able to fulfill those costs. And so that's one problem that I think most farmers I see have. The second one is a lack of control through no one's fault, really, just sort of a lack of awareness of all the different intermediaries that play a part in agriculture. A farmer is contracted from the moment he buys seed all the way through to harvest and getting it out to the market space, whether commodity-based selling or direct to consumer. Every single piece of that operation has a different contract. And so a lot of farmers are feeling hand-tied by the amount of contracts and basically don't own any piece of it. They're just the cogwheel, the person that's driving the cogwheel to try to make it all work. And so there's this overwhelming sense of, I don't have any control of what I'm doing. I'm being dictated to and through all those contracts. The third piece that, again, I enter the conversation of, well, what if you could have some control? What if we can change that? Certainly open. And then the third one is this creating legacy. You know, I think a lot of rural communities want to make sure that they have an ability to pass on this land and this lifestyle to the new generation. And from my perspective, when I'm talking to people my age, and maybe a bit younger than me, you know, how do we get you reinvigorated into thinking about agriculture as something that's fun and not a low level blue collar job, but something that has meaning and purpose. And again, I think this decentralized ledger blockchain, this Web3 world allows for those conversations to happen. And so for me, how do I get them engaged? I ask questions and then I ask, what if? Would you be interested? If we could focus on one of those three elements and start to make a difference, is that something that you would like to explore? And I haven't met somebody yet that says no. And we certainly walk down many different paths on how that's going to look. What I try not to do is demonize what I call the messy middle. And I think there's a lot of people that point fingers. I simply want to flip the narrative. You know, that messy middle we've created. And so there's a recognition that, you know, we're part of that messy middle. And that's, you know, the intermediaries, distribution, supply chains, even consumers to a degree in terms of their, you know, their, the way that we've taught them to look at food and look at products and consume it. I continue to talk about in Canada, you know, we go into a grocer and everyone wants avocados and bananas, two things that we don't grow in Canada natively, but they want it year round. And, you know, we've taught them to do that. We've taught them to look at carrots that need to be bright orange and long and skinny with a green tail, as opposed to, you know, all different colors and shapes and sizes. And, you know, think about the nutritional factor. And so we got to change that uneducate what we have educated them to think about. And so sort of it's an unwinding of knowledge base. But we need to just start small. And so that messy middle can't be demonized. We need to flip the conversation. And so it's both an educational and changing the narrative of how we go from soil to consumer, and whatever that may look like through all the different channels, and introducing an ability for us to do that. And so that's technology. Technology's is very accessible for everyone, even in very rural areas. I was in South Africa in December, and I've been talking to a lot of people in Brazil and Peru as of late. And even there, technology is becoming more accessible and more accessible. And I think these things here, these cell phones are allowing that connectivity. And even through something so small, and it provides us such opportunity to embed an ability to flip that narrative. And I'm speaking in a little bit high level right now. I understand that because there's inherent problems with how we create these technologies, but that's a whole different conversation, you know, from rare earth minerals and the extraction of the earth and mines. But just thinking about the conversations, and to answer your question, what are the mechanisms that are going to help us get there most efficiently to embed some of this new technology, to flip those conversations so we can take on some of these pain points that they feel are, you know, weighting them down and not providing them opportunities to go further. And then embedded within that is an ability to look at data differently. And so, you know, I talked about the house at the farm that I live in, some of the different mechanisms that you brought up, filtration of water. We start to look at data and what it's showing us, and then we can use that data as a trust mechanism so that we can start making actual system changes in our environments. I was smacked heavily last week in a conversation with somebody that said, pretty much every piece of information I get given, my immediate reaction is fake news. Again, it's an inherent, you know, teaching of society that we shouldn't trust anything that is digital or told to us. And I just felt so deflated, because I would hope when I look at information, I inherently want to believe it first, and then I will go do some research on the pieces that I feel might be a little bit outside of what, you know, is being indicated to me or shown to me. But I think there's probably more a resounding lean towards what I was confronted with last week, which is I immediately don't trust it and I go the opposite direction. And so we need to bring an ability to trust components so that we can make system changes. And again, this is where I enter some of the benefits of coming with a distributed ledger and some of the, you know, Web3 as a whole blockchain that fits in there. We can start to create these trust mechanisms so that we can create system changes, and those system changes will start to have a domino effect in all those other areas we talked about. And I explain that without getting into the new vocabulary of this emerging technology, how we can start to do that and conquer some of these pain points that these individuals have. But I try not to get into big giga picture problem solving and just focus on one element. And then we just use blocks, step in blocks, right? And one element's next, stacks onto the next, and stacks onto the next.
But at the same time, you've also shown that you start very concrete in one of a limited set of questions that resonates with basically everybody in the field. And in my experience, regardless where you start, if you start probing the system you're embedded in a deep inquiry, for example, you go out and ask the question, what does my bank do with the money?
Mm-hmm.
And then you follow that money into that direction and see that it's actually working against your long-term interests
mm-hmm.
often. Or you follow the question of where does the banana actually come from? Or
mm-hmm.
Why is everything wrapped in single-use plastic? Any of these questions unravel the bigger picture that you're embedded in,
mm-hmm.
which then offers the opportunity for an actual systemic change, which is overwhelming in the beginning. We know it, we feel it, right? That's yeah. where we more or less started this conversation, where we can sense that there is a different way of life that we want to live, but we cannot live it for some reason. And now we can start unpacking that piece by piece without being overwhelmed and suddenly
yeah.
find ourselves in a more healthy world.
Yeah.
Is that what you're after, more or less, in the
absolutely
big leap salami tactic?
Yes. Yeah, you're right on point. You're as I say in agriculture, you're picking up what I'm swathing. Mm-hmm. It will absolutely allow us to have those big leaps, and you're right on point with, you know, how we can get there, and you know, based off of what I've said and rephrase that very well and very eloquently. So yeah, it's great.
Nice. Now, when we look at this big picture, that's something that is more felt than understood.
Mm-hmm.
Also the need for the change. And it's a bit like when I look at the lines on the hat you're wearing,
mm-hmm.
they give me a sense, right? So those lines, I don't see the lines. I see a word. I see a meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And there was a moment in my life when that happened to me, when I started turning lines into meaning.
Mm.
Right?
I like
there's a deep insight that I cannot unsee.
Mm-hmm. Right?
It's embedded in me. And similarly to how the cultural fabric of your family and then maybe the bigger Canadian cultural fabric gave you certain insights, like of that category, that give you a certain perspective into the world that allow you to do the things that you do. You look at all of us.
Mm-hmm.
The 8 billion of us.
Mm-hmm.
And you imagine a inside of that category, of that depth, that you would like us all to have, that would make it easier for us to start unraveling and taking that big leap and all of that together.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of insight would you hope for?
That is a question that I'll try to answer in the best I can. I think it's one of those questions that will sit with me for the rest of the week here, Thomas, and I'll probably come up with 5 or 6 different answers to explain it. But I think it's a great question in the sense that it's forcing us to think about those, as you mentioned, those feelings that we don't often pay attention to, that are going to allow us some different conversations. And maybe to drill it down for some of the listeners that might be on this, would be my hope would be that when we engage with food, we have a better understanding of how it was grown and where it came from and how it's making us feel. And I think ultimately that for me, would be something that really fulfills me and allows me to understand that we've gotten to a spot that I'm trying to get us to from the little small area that I'm focusing on. The second part is, as we start to be more in tune with what food means both to us, both our health and, you know, where it comes from and how it was grown, it allows us to innovate differently. And so I'm hoping that it will give us different abilities to recognize that we can do things in different areas of our life, you know, that outside of agriculture and soil and energy, that are going to propel us forward. You know, I have a lot of conversations with people about electric cars and what that means. And, you know, we're not going to go down that rabbit hole today, but we need to start having those outside of the box, thinking about what's in front of us. But I think it really does start with understanding our foods and how it makes us feel and where it comes from, because it's going to, you know, present to us in such a, it's one of those core element pieces that has feeling, right? I talked about breaking bread and that connection with community and those stories. We're not just putting plastic down, we're tasting flavors, we're tasting different explosions. And even if you don't travel a lot, even if you're someone that likes to stay, you know, within your little bioregion, just through the flavors of tastes of foods that, you know, people are cooking and how it's prepared for you, it opens up different senses and it allows us to feel different things. And I think that's why it's such a powerful medium for us to really understand. And the question that I like to leave everyone with is, find out who grew your food. If you don't know where your food was grown, find out who was the farmer. And I don't mean what grocery store or what distribution or supply chain it came from, but who grew it? What community or what farm entity grew it? And read their story, those origin stories, those impactful stories. They're usually on the web somewhere. You know, most farms have some sort of story. The more we connect with the people that are growing our food, the more it tastes different. Even though the mechanisms of growing it may not have changed, it gives us a connectivity, and that interconnectivity, I think, is going to be that second sign that, you know, we've gotten to that place of feeling that we're doing things differently. So hopefully that provides an answer. Mm-hmm.
If you come up with more during the week, feel free to record and send over. I'll just add it to the end.
Sounds good. Yeah, you're on.
But it leads me to another thought that's basically why I described earlier before. But if you know where your food was grown, you might also start being interested in where was your information grown. And who grew your information, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it might pique your curiosity and start giving you a taste for different flavors of information that might be more nutritious or not, and how to engage with them or not, right? Mm-hmm. So again, it fans out from one very specific grounded example, which I totally love, that it's something that's doable. All of us could do this, start doing this today.
Yeah.
So thank you for that insight. I'd love to have that. Love to have that continuous exploration of where my food came from.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
So for me, it's... noon for you, it's very early, right?
It is, yes. We're getting the day started in Canada, yeah.
So thank you for this late morning for me, and I hope you had a really also a nice early morning, and thank you so much also for the work that you're doing on behalf of all of us. I think it's a very, very important work, and we can only all do this together. We can pull it off together easily, but we have to do it together.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Thomas. It's been a pleasure to be here. I love starting my weeks off with these meaningful conversations. I think they drive me, and I will certainly take you up if I have some more pieces that come to mind here. I'll record them and send them your way. But beautiful. For everyone listening, for everyone that's partaken and spent some time to digest what we've been talking about, thank you as well. And I hope that some exploration around some of these pieces that we've talked about, you know, it triggers a little noodle in the brain to go explore and ask some questions around food, soil, and some of those other very important pieces. So
absolutely. And we can put information in the show notes that allow people to reach out to you so that anybody who wants to speak with you can do so.
Wonderful.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Likewise. Take care.